Oh, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we convene the Science Forum. We've gathered a panel of science experts to respond to your questions and comments. They love it when we call them experts. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet us if you wish, at WAMC Radio, and then just use the hashtag Vox Pop. Go to our Facebook page, WAMC Radio. There'll be a Vox Pop post there. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or a call. It's a call-in show. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. All right, scientists, let's sign in, please.
I'm Helmut Hirsch, Emeritus Professor of Biology, SUNY Albany, currently Adjunct Professor at SUNY ESF in Environmental Studies.
Helmut, great to have you back on the show.
Ed Stander, geology, astronomy, esoteric science, and anything that Barbara can't answer.
And juggler, right?
And juggler, from SUNY Cobleskill.
Right, you are. And and our third, but certainly not least.
Well, certainly not. And to complete the SUNY table here, SUNY Cobleskill, Barbara Bravets, I'm a biochemist.
Okay, well, nice to have you all here. Now, Ed, you had mentioned that several months ago, you had homework.
It actually is great because it shows that I do not have Alzheimer's. It's been that long.
Good. So was this the last time you were on the show, or
yes,
you just forgot to do your homework?
No, it was the last time I was on the show. I've had the information in my hot little hands for over 2 months now.
All right. Well, let's re-examine what the question was and then what the answer is.
The question had to do, and this is really cool, with the fact that when you're boiling water, it doesn't produce steam. But as soon as you stop boiling the water, as soon as you turn the heat off, the steam comes on.
All right, what's the answer?
Yes.
that's not good. No.
And he was so excited about this after the other show. He was giddy with,
well,
let's go boil water.
For a while, I thought it was no, but I've come to the conclusion since then that the answer actually is
that's
yes.
That's not helpful.
I need more information.
Is this
if
one
this
of those common
test,
core questions?
Yes.
Because all right, so what's the real answer?
Well, I don't know if it's the real answer, but it's my answer. I went home and I put some water on the gas stove and I turned it on. And it boiled, and there was no steam, and I turned it off, the steam came on. So first of all, I would like to point out that, yes, the person was right, that that is actually what happens.
Okay, and then why?
Well, apparently what happens, I believe happens, is this. First of all, the steam coming off of the pot is actually superheated steam.
Okay.
And superheated steam doesn't produce steam because it's just superheated. There you go.
Well, we can't see it.
We can't see it.
It's in a gas phase.
But it's gone. Anyway.
Okay.
As soon as you turn off the heat, what happens is all the heat that's coming up from around the pot effectively forms a cone of heat, which keeps air from outside from getting into the steam train. And as soon as you turn it off, it stops that extra heat that's around the outside of the burner.
Oh, yeah.
It's around the pot. It disappears and allows air from outside to come in. That air coming in from outside has a lot of water in it, a lot of moisture, but it's not superheated, and as a result, it immediately goes and forms steam.
Amazing. All right, let's peer review this. People, what do you think?
Well, technically, it's not steam. It's a condensation.
Okay, condensation.
When you see the cloud in the sky, it's
nice,
not
thanks.
Steam. I can hit him on the radio.
Yeah, that's
can
fine.
I, right?
People watching at WAMC.org
right.
can see you strike, Ed.
Yes, we can have them call in and tell me where they'd like me to hit him.
Good thing, too. All yeah. right, continue.
But it's condensation that you're seeing. So it's actually going from the gas phase back to the liquid phase, and that's what we see. Just like when it's cold out and you breathe out and you see that cloud that comes out of your mouth. We call it steam, but it's actually condensed water.
Mm, okay. Helmut.
Well, it sounds reasonable to me. And
that's all you got.
That's all I've got. No,
gosh, Helmut, we could have hit him from both sides.
I'm going to let Helmut go now.
That was terrific, Helmut. All right, let's go to the phones. Francis in Pittsfield. Francis, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
If I were to take a deep breath, would I get more oxygen in the dense Arctic cold weather that we've had, or late spring when everything's blooming?
Hmm.
In your lungs or in your blood?
If I take a deep breath.
But are you talking about
lungs? Is there more oxygen in the dense cold Arctic air that we had this winter than in the late spring when everything's blooming?
Well, the denser the atmosphere, the more oxygen there is, typically, all other things being equal. But we're not talking about a tremendous difference. It's
24%.
Right. It's not that much, and it certainly won't affect your ability to perform based on the amount of oxygen that you get or don't get. In fact, sometimes the cold air will create other physiologic effects in your lungs that will decrease your performance.
Hmm.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thanks, Francis. We appreciate the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Just like when you jump into the cold part of the pool, you get that,
oh, yeah.
All those muscles constrict because
everything constricts.
Your body says, oh,
yeah.
This isn't what I was thinking I was doing today.
And then presumably you're using more energy to keep yourself warm.
Right, and to keep your muscles warm.
That would counteract any advantage of...
Does it close up the alveoli in the lungs as well?
It shuts down. It doesn't actually. I don't know if it makes the alveoli smaller, but it shuts down the blood supply to a certain extent to the alveoli.
I would
actually
imagine.
Cold produces an asthmatic reaction in people who have asthma. So
yes.
Presumably it is closing up the bronchi.
Right. Bronchi are much bigger than the alveoli. They're the main tubes as opposed to the tiny grapelets at the ends of the tubes in your lungs. But the main trunks do get constricted, just like as my mouth, apparently, in the cold.
So you mentioned 24% is the ratio for oxygen. So when you go to halfway up Mount Everest, when you go, and you say there's not a great deal of difference, but when you're in more rarefied conditions.
Oh, there's a great difference there.
And so what's the percentage when you go up to, say, a mile?
You get up into the upper teens, and you can definitely feel it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, I was actually up in Tibet at 15,000 feet, and I discovered that not only do you breathe very, very, very fast to get enough oxygen in your lungs, but you have to go to the bathroom about six times a night.
You're kidding
me. Because
your
body is...
It's trying to concentrate your blood.
That's right.
Your body has many different responses to this, and one of the short-term/long-term effects is to try to increase platelet concentration, increase red blood cell concentration, so you have a better effective freeway to move what little oxygen you do have. So you got to lose fluid to do that. So you can't just get more blood without getting rid of water.
So would then someone who has sleep apnea, who's having trouble bringing oxygen in, have to go to the John more often in the middle of the night?
That's a great experiment, but I don't want that one for
Could that
homework.
Be homework? A helmet?
Please not.
Sure, why not?
All right, fair enough. All right, let's go back to the phones.
We're going to have to set him up with a clothespin.
Thank you.
This is taking a really disturbing turn. Let's go to Amanda in Belchertown, Mass. Amanda, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, experts. My question is, I don't know exactly the term for it. The pesticide glyphosate,
right.
I heard affects bees because it's a nano something.
It's a nicotinamide.
Yes, and I was wondering if you could talk about that and how it affects the bees, and I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks, okay? Amanda. We appreciate
Great,
it.
Thanks.
Okay.
Well, I'll say that the body of evidence that nicotinamide seemed to be a part of colony collapse in bees does get stronger, but it is by no means a slam dunk that this is cause and effect. But nicotinamides are a class of pesticides that are used worldwide. They're legal. You can buy them at the store. Many of the seeds that you actually buy, like in a packet, to then put into the ground in order to stop little critters from eating your seed before it sprouts, they're coated in them. And it seems to have two effects. One of which is it seems to attract the bees to the product, the plant product, and to selectively grab the pollen from plants that have this nicotinamide either applied to them on the seed coat or applied to them on the plant later on. So you end up with this accumulation of the nicotinamides within the colony. That's for sure.
Okay.
So then the question is, what physiological chain of events could result in bee death or bee morbidity? And it could just be another chink in the bee's armor, and that if something else comes along, like the parasites that exist within these colonies, it just pushes them over the edge and the bee's colony collapses.
So I assume there are studies now ongoing about this.
There was just one announced yesterday or the day before, which is probably why the caller asked, and I believe it was a study in Europe that was pretty extensive. I think it was the UK, actually. Pretty extensive look at how nicotinamides are transported from the plant through the bee to the colony and watching that.
And do they know the detrimental effect, the actual physiological detrimental effect on the bees?
At the molecular level, they don't know.
So you had mentioned cause and effect. And then so that's when they know something causes something. Right now it's just a correlation, is that?
I would say that it's a strong correlation, and science is a progressive field. We need to get down to the brass tacks, to pardon the bee pun, but it's difficult to look at the molecular level of the actions of any insult to a system, and that's the whole field of toxicology. So it takes money mainly to have scientists to work on this. So that's really what it comes down to, is having the people to look into this.
But if you'd like to send some money, we'll accept it.
That's a typical Ed response. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take go ahead, Helmut.
Quick comment. Does anybody, or question really, does anybody know whether these are endocrine disruptors? A lot of the pesticides are. And that could be another way it could be affecting the bees.
Let's hold that thought and take a break. 1-800-348-2551. We're joined on the Science Forum by Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, and Helmut Hirsch. We'll be back.
Support comes from Lori Stillwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. Empire State Youth Orchestra, performing Grieg, Hindemith, Berlioz, and Rosaro's Marimba Concerto at Troy Savings Bank Music Hall this Saturday, 7:30 p.m. ESYO.org for more information. And Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harrells.com. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their new website with more information about memberships, grants, and loans. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. And the Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care. CECAA.com.
Vox Pop, the Science Forum on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Oh, the lines are loaded. So are the guests. Helmut, you had mentioned you had a question, a follow-up.
My question was whether these pesticides that we were just talking about affect the endocrine system, and a lot of pesticides do. And if so, that can potentially change the animal's behavior, and the effects of endocrine disruptors are multi-generational. They are transmitted not by genetic means in the classical sense, but what we now refer to as epigenetic changes. We've been doing work on that on lead, and it passes through the female. I don't know, of course, whether that applies to bees or any other insects.
That's a great question, and I could take that as homework
Okay. And
give a nice review the next time I'm here.
Fair enough. That's great. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. I don't know, panel, if you've noticed, but our call screener, Deb Malik, uses Roman numerals.
Oh,
isn't that nice? That's
very nice. I have to teach some of my students who are not from the U.S. what the Roman numeral system is, because right, they're not familiar with
now,
it.
Now, if we get up in the thousands,
it gets
of
pretty
calls,
tricky.
Yeah, we'll have M's and it'll be confusing. All right, let's go to Jim in Adams, Mass. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
I was wondering also on that last question on the bees, if someone could take a look at whether or not the organically raised bee colonies are having these same effects or to the same degree as the ones that are, you know, doused with chemicals conventionally and all. But my question, I guess you've got it there in front of you. I've noticed a lot of the cedar trees and shrubs and things around the Berkshire County area. I haven't noticed anywhere else I've gone, but around here anyway, are showing up in these rusty brown patches and some whole areas of their foliage all dried out to this rusty brown color, and I'm wondering if anyone has any idea what might be causing this, if it's the acid rain having a further effect on our evergreens. We've lost a lot of spruce trees already. Different types of spruces aren't resistant and been submitting. Anyone
Jim,
have
I
any ideas?
I have a question for you, just a clarification. Mm-hmm. Are you talking about kind of like the needles are browning, or are you talking
the needles, the foliage is browning right out.
Okay, because there's
rusty
another...
Red, brown.
There's another pest in cedars. I think it's called apple smut, which looks like kind of like a wet mushroomy thing that kind of grows like a truffle on cedars in particular, and that's just a community pest, unfortunately.
Where does that grow, in the bark or the tree?
It grows right all over the branches and what you would consider the leaves.
I've been looking at these closely somewhat, and the foliage elsewhere on the trees all looks normal and dry and fine and green and all, but then you get this stuff that all rusty browns out, and then the trees are starting to dry out, it looks like.
So. Well, I will tell you that I hang out with some very smart botanist people who also put, but I am not, who post things on Facebook that I read. And I did see that cedars are particularly susceptible to wind damage. And we had an enormously windy and cold.
This was last summer I saw it.
Right. But even so, wind happens every winter.
Yeah.
And so if you get those exposed northern sides that you get the wind blowing.
Well, I noticed it on the first time I noticed was over in a farm store in Lanesboro. It was on the southern side of a whole big line of cedar trees that were in a hedge configuration. This was on the south side, actually.
And then the one other possibility that I can think of to help you kind of narrow it down would be salt spray from a road. It's very damaging.
These are way removed from the road.
Jim, I got a great idea. Okay. Fred Breglia is the arborist at the Landis Arboretum, and he every time we do a gardening show, he is here. Dollars to donuts, he will be all over that question.
He's the one who's my friend.
Ray's my expert on everything.
All right, man. Hey, thanks for calling.
All right.
See you later. All right. Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, you're on.
Hi. Well, I called because I heard there's a geologist on.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have a geology question, but very quickly, before I ask that question, I would just like to personally say that I have a beautiful garden, and I've never used a pesticide in it. I've never needed to, and I think Americans and the world in general use pesticides to a degree that is kind of insane, and I wish people would, like, stop. And dandelions, don't kill them. Eat them. I eat mine.
Delicious.
They're delicious. And you should have a dandelion, a Food Friday dandelion.
You know, I've actually had that. We did a show on, you know, foraging and whatnot, and
I missed it.
It was interesting. So you have a question?
Yes, my question is: I have a small fenced backyard, and for a while, regularly, I was picking up all these little rocks all over the yard. I mean, small ones up to the sort of size of my hand, and I gathered them all up and I moved them out to a different location. And sure enough, by the next year, they were all back, and they keep coming back. And every time I go out in the yard, especially after this winter, I go out in the yard, and all these rocks are back. And you can't see that they've come up out of the ground, but they must have, you know, unless somebody is sneaking into my backyard and throwing all the rocks back in, which I don't think is happening.
Okay.
So what's that about? What kind of action is that? Does it have a name? Is it true all over the place? Because it's not true in other parts of my property.
Ed.
Yeah, I've had so many things go through my mind, so many funny things that I'm trying to get them out of my mind.
Okay.
Ed was thinking about coming down to your place and just putting rocks back.
Well, I was thinking that you should get them in your car and move them far away so they can't come back.
Like mice, when you catch mice.
Exactly.
Traps.
No, it's frost heaving, mostly.
Really?
It's the same thing that happens, for example, that brings up arrowheads in farmers' fields every year.
Uh-huh.
And what happens effectively is the ground freezes to about 3 to 4 feet down, and ice grows upwards, and it lifts the rocks up a certain distance each year.
Huh.
And then when the ice disappears, the rocks don't fall back down again because effectively the ground has fallen underneath them, so they stay in the same position. So they continuously pop up over year after year after year from the same spot. And generally speaking, if it happens, it's because you've got a relatively shallow water table there. If you dig down 3 or 4 feet, you'll probably hit water.
Yes.
So is that why in some part of our yard it happens more than in others?
That's right.
Hmm.
Yeah, it just depends on how much water there is in the ground, and it comes up by capillary action between the soil. So it also depends on the type of soil that's there.
Wow, and that will just go on kind of forever.
Forever and ever until all the rocks are gone.
Or all the water's
gone.
Hey, Harriet, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wow, that was an interesting one. Let's
now,
go.
What I would suggest is for her is that next time she gets a bunch of rocks up there, she put an X on them and move them out of the way so to make sure they don't come back.
Great idea. Let's go to Lou in Altamont. Lou.
Yes, gold appears to be scattered all over the world. Yet when I try to locate a source to attempt to mine gold or pan gold in New York State, there's very little information available in geological books, local mineral clubs. I found one record of a mine of a gold panning operation historically outside of Saratoga over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Why is there such an absence of gold in New York State?
Because gold usually forms as in igneous bodies from what are called batholiths, which are effectively molten rock. And gold is the last thing to crystallize out of these. So as the body of igneous rocks cools, crystals fall down to the bottom, and you're left with a liquid at the top that contains, for the most part, your precious metals and things like quartz.
Oh.
Which is why, for example, when people are looking for gold, they look for veins of quartz, because the gold and the quartz are often related to each other. They sort of squeeze out at the last moment and shoot into the country rock around the area.
Huh.
And around here, especially in New York, there are very few igneous bodies of that type. There's the Adirondacks, of course, but it was a very, very different type of melt that it started out with. So we don't have gold here as compared to, for example, out west where there's a lot of it. It all depends on what the source rock is and what the source of the magma is. And around here, we don't have the right stuff.
There you go. Lou, great
question.
All right,
thank you.
Thanks
You're
a
welcome.
Lot. We appreciate it. Over to Carl in Middlefield, Mass. Carl.
Yes. I have a mini farm up in Middlefield, Mass. Anyway, I've got a wildcat that's been around my property for about 3-4 days. And he has all the markings of a bobcat. You know, he's got the short bobtail with the black and white tip. He's got the white tipped ears with a little black wisp on it. But he's so small, I can't believe he's a bobcat. He's about the size of a Cocker Spaniel. Do they actually come that small, or is he like a half-breed? Did he, with something made with a cat or something?
Okay.
No, that's about the size. I mean, they do certainly get bigger with age, but they don't get substantially. A Cocker Spaniel, my gosh, that's actually pretty big. We have several of them at Cobleskill because we have a flourishing fisheries and wildlife bachelor's program, and we have unfortunate roadkills that come to us in the dead of night that we then taxidermy and then we have as display specimens for the students. And I used to have one on my office desk because, you know, it was better than papers. Anyway, it was not... I would say it was smaller than a Cocker Spaniel. This was they had done some dating to figure out about how old it was from its teeth, and it was a 6 or 7 year old bobcat, and it was, I don't know, I'd say smaller than a Cocker Spaniel, maybe larger than a Jack Russell, heftier than a Jack Russell.
Yes,
certainly much larger than a house cat. You would not mistake them for a house cat.
Oh, no, definitely not. He's a husky little guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because we had one on the property last year that was easy twice the size of it. I mean, he had to be a good 20 inches at the shoulder, if not larger.
Hmm.
And Helmut, the only other cat around with a bobtail is a lynx, right? And
right.
They would be further north.
I would think so.
Yeah.
The other thing is sexual dimorphism. I mean, last year's may have been a male, and this could be a female. And that could be part of the difference, account for part of the difference in size.
There's actually been quite a resurgence in wild cat populations and wild weasel populations.
Really?
Fisher cat, which are weasels, are really making quite a comeback. They were very rare in New York, and for some reason, it seems they think somehow it's correlated with a downturn in raccoon rabies that the fisher are making quite a comeback.
Wow, good news indeed. Carl, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay, you're welcome. I've seen one of them fisher cats on my property, and an ermine, and a weasel, and a minx, so we've had everything up here.
That's terrific.
Yeah, nice.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Let's go to Steve in Albany. Steve.
Yes, you were talking about sleep apnea briefly before, I had asked the doctor almost exactly the question about nighttime urination.
Yeah.
And they told me that the sleep apnea has a side effect of causing a kidney hormone production, which increases the amount of urine, which would cause
amazing.
A stress
more
hormone.
Urination.
That would be a stress
there
hormone.
There you go. That's good information. Thank you, Steve.
The same reason you have to pee right before you go on the air.
Something I just happened to know. I know that.
Thank you very much for doing my homework for me. Yeah. I really appreciate
Helmet's
it.
Helmet's off the hook, Steve. Thank you.
But the question is, can you sleep through it?
Unfortunately. Let's hope you don't.
Oh, boy. All right. Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Over to Jim in Poughkeepsie. Jim.
Yes, hi. I just have a follow-up comment on the gentleman called before about seeing the evergreens with the rust spot areas. There was just an article this past weekend in the Poughkeepsie Journal suggesting that a lot of that sort of symptom that we're seeing on compact evergreens is coming from spider mites. We've noticed a lot of them here in the Hudson Valley area, and these short needle shrubs that are in cemeteries and landscapes, and I've never seen it before, and it seems to be pretty epidemic. And and this article in the Poughkeepsie Journal showed a picture of a shrub with this large rust area in it, just like we're seeing all over in the landscapes. And there was an arborist there that suggested it was coming from spider mites.
Hmm. Well, spider mites, for our listeners, are really easy to figure out because they make a nesty type of thing on the inner part of the branch. So you look for what looks like a cluster of spider webs, and that means spider mites.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. We appreciate the call. Open line right now at 1-800-348-2551. Javon in Hudson. Javon.
Yes. I have a question.
Sure.
You guys were talking about height earlier and what happened to your body when you have certain height. Mm-hmm. And I'm from the Caribbean, and I fly so often, go home, visit my family and stuff like that. And when the plane is descending, I got like this popping in my ears, like my head is gonna explode. I'm wondering if one of your scientists could answer that, see what that was, what that is.
That's
you guys can, and I'll listen to the radio.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
First of all, it's bad airplanes as far as the airplane
really?
Company is
not
concerned.
Good pressurization?
They're not pressurizing the thing well enough. But mainly what it is you have a tube going from the back of your throat into your ear, which is supposed to... Behind your eardrum, that is supposed to equalize the air pressure from the one side of your ear and the other side of your ear.
Is it the eustachian tubes?
Eustachian tube.
Okay. Because you need that drum to still be nice and tight, a nice tight snare drum so you can hear.
Right. And if you happen to have an infection in that eustachian tube, or you happen to have a small one like I do, then no matter what happens, when you start going down, if the pressure's not properly equalized, your eardrum starts to go.
Yeah.
And just to let you know, what I usually do if that happens is I close off my nose with my finger like this, and then
That's nice.
Yeah, it's great.
Thanks.
And then I breathe in, close my mouth, and put a pressure in like I'm trying to blow my nose, and that usually forces the air up through the tube to equalize the air.
People always recommend gum. Does that have any effect?
Sometimes.
Just moves your jaw back and forth, which is right next to the tube, and kind of gives it a little bit more of a kneading effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I've actually blown eardrums that way.
Oh, I had one. I was on a flight. Ears didn't really pop. Came home. I was playing a trombone in a blues band. Came home, played that night. Pop the eardrum right on out.
Well, the trombone did it. Blowing.
After being on the flight and not ear popping, and then, that happens.
So Javon should Google what the flight attendants and the pilots do, because they do it every day, and they have to travel with colds and allergies and all the other things that can really interfere with that equilibrium.
Yeah, try holding your nose and blowing it at the same time.
And just watch everyone's reaction. Because it'll be hilarious.
Well, they never do. They're always looking at the kid in the back of the plane that can't do that and screaming.
Helmet, are you awake over there?
Yes, of course I'm awake.
I haven't heard much.
I was going to add the comment, which is that don't overdo it. I was watching Ed do it, and he puts a lot of body English into it.
Yeah.
And I think I would suggest being gentle, because I think you can't overdo it And I think for our insurance purposes, we should caution people.
Okay, you mean from a radio station
standpoint? Yeah,
thank you for looking out for us. Yeah, the legal department.
You could blow your own eardrum.
That's right. You know what? Anything Ed says, I think you should vet with your doctor.
Well, I blow my own horn all the
or
time.
Or your clergy.
So,
yeah.
I would say psychologist or psychiatrist, but that's all right.
All right.
But it does work, and it has saved my life many times.
And you fly a lot?
A lot.
Yeah. And so some planes are better than others? I don't fly very often.
Gosh, yes. Bigger planes usually have a much better system than smaller planes, for example. Hmm. And if you're going from 30,000 feet to zero in a matter of 3 or 4 minutes or 5 minutes, it can put a lot of pressure on your drum.
Interesting. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Barbara Bravitz, Ed Stander, and Helmut Hirsch. Yeah, we call it the Science Forum. And we do it every once in a while. Nice to have you here. Zach, engineer, man, let's take a break.
Support comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Washington County Tourism, announcing Farm and Fiber Tour, self-guided tour featuring spinning, knitting, and weaving demonstrations, showcasing alpacas, goats, and sheep. This Saturday and Sunday, WashingtonNYCounty.com. Kent Hicks Construction, West Chesterfield, Massachusetts, specializing in energy-efficient, net-zero passive house home building, deep energy retrofits, and historical restorations, serving Western Massachusetts. KentHicksConstruction.com. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. And the Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years, independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.kendall.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Barbara, you had mentioned at the beginning of the show that microbeads are much on your mind.
Yeah, it's been in the news lately, and it's certainly been something that in the scientific community we've been discussing for a number of years, but I just thought I would bring it out to the audience because Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General for New York, had just made a recommendation that microbeads be banned in New York State, but that is very preliminary at this moment. Microbeads are found in personal care products and shampoos, toothpastes, certain makeups, cosmetics, and what they do is they're microabrasives or microlubricants, and they're usually tiny, tiny beads that you really don't notice that make things smoother, or they can formulate them differently to be microabrasive.
Like an exfoliant.
Yeah, like an acne wash could
right.
have them in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're made out of plastic, petroleum plastic, like same as your water bottle. Same type of plastic, which is a relatively inert substance. It doesn't really biodegrade, and that tends to be one of the problems. So it turns out that a lot of the invertebrates in your water supply are filter feeders, like your clams, your mussels.
Uh-huh.
They'll suck in the water. The microbeads will get lodged in them, and then they can't siphon the microbeads out, and it can really impact the environment and certainly their ecosystem. Even in fish, we've seen that some gills in areas that have much higher microbead concentrations can become clogged with microbeads, which of course effectively chokes off the oxygen supply to the fish. But one of the around the Great Lakes, there's been more studies than most, because all of those old wastewater treatment plants from all of the Rust Belt are dumping in our microbeads, which don't get filtered out in the wastewater process. They're just ejected.
Mm-hmm.
They have found a troubling trend that not only do the microbeads accumulate, but because the microbeads are plastic, they attract other organic, not in the good sense, products, including things like pesticides, including things like PCBs, which may be still in the environment, and concentrate them on the surface of the bead. So we may end up with much more toxic concentrations through unintended consequences of having cleaner skin and brighter teeth.
Well, what about an unintended consequence that perhaps this is a way we can clean water.
There are zeolites and other, I know that sounds
which is
like
a rock.
Which is a rock, not a bead. But they can be constructed to do this type of filtering. And I worked on that, gosh, I don't know, 16 years ago.
So did I.
But microbeads could be used as a filtration, but right now they're not regulated. There's not even a standard way to test for them.
So you said they're in toothpaste as well?
Yeah.
Plastic?
Plastic. You gotta.
What the heck?
Well, you know, that kind of gritty feeling, you gotta get that from somewhere.
That's plastic?
Yep.
Some of it is, yes.
One of the things to think about is that these microbeads have incredible surface area.
Yes.
Because when you subdivide something enough times, you're increasing the surface area. And those kind of reactions where organic substances are adhering to it, they're so significant because of the surface area. And that would explain part of their ability to concentrate it. And I think that's something we often don't think about. And I'm wondering also what effect they would have inside us or any other organism, whether they would affect communication across cell walls, for example.
Very interesting.
It is interesting. And if you just think about it, we have EPA limits on what we can have for some of these toxic materials. But if they're in a microbead, even if the EPA limit in the water is part per billion, you may be getting much higher concentrations if you happen to get the sample with the microbeads in it.
That's, you know what? It would seem to me they could make one that would break down.
Certainly they could. Right. They could.
Let's go back to the phones. Chuck in Hudson. Chuck.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm calling up about a tree that I pass by all the time in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same color as the Granny Smith apple, the fruit that hangs off it. What I don't know if they're fruit or not, but they look all like they're worms wrapped around. They're all wiggly.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what that is?
There's worms on the fruit?
Oh, there's not worms on it, but there's
a bean plant.
Vine on it. Like that.
There's a vine on the tree. Okay.
Design.
Oh, design.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to defer back to Fred Braigley again.
Let's do it at the let's do it on the next gardening show, Chuck. And Fred Braigley, who is our resident arborist, should be able to find that out for you.
Yeah, the same color as a Granny Smith apple, but they're about the size of a baseball, softball.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
all wiggly lines on them.
All right,
that's the same color.
All right, Chuck. Well, we'll have you back on the gardening show, and we'll take a look at that. Douglas in Saratoga Lake. Douglas, you're on.
Hey, thanks for an absolutely incredibly positive forum, gentlemen. And just to let you
and
know,
lady,
up here,
don't forget the lady. It's Barbara.
I'll take gentlemen as long as he's including me too.
Gentle folks.
Persons.
Right.
Okay. We just had snow flurries up here. They're gone now.
Yeah.
I started off with what would be an arborist sort of question, but I'm going to defer to a general question. I think one of your panel members was a geologist there from Cobleskill.
Yeah.
General comment, in your forums or any of your meetings, do you have any thoughts about the issue of, first of all, hydrofracking and general oil drilling and how it may affect tectonic plates and the potential resultant earthquake factor?
It's all over the news.
Yeah, well, that was first discovered in Denver, Colorado, when the government was pumping mustard gas water into the ground without telling anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they pumped it in, there was an earthquake. Effectively, all you're doing is moving two rocks apart and therefore decreasing the pressure that's holding them together, and that can cause earthquakes. So it really all depends on the environment where it happens. Around here, and even in Pennsylvania, there have been earthquakes, but they're relatively small because the tectonic forces within the rocks are also relatively small. Most of the things that happened down in that area happened about 340 million years ago, and the pressures associated with that have relieved to a good extent. Mm. So it depends entirely on where you are.
And so Oklahoma, because it's in the news of having, you know, vastly more earthquakes now because of potential oil drilling.
Well, a lot
what
of
is
that,
it about? Is it because their soil is different, that their bedrock's different?
It's because in those places they're depleting the groundwater and the oil so much that the ground is sinking. And so the pressures are not coming from the side but from top and bottom. For example, Houston has dropped about 40 feet from the center of the town to the edge of the town, and there are cracks surrounding the city. effectively as the ground sinks where they're taking materials out. Same thing with Las Vegas. Sacramento Valley has dropped 50 feet in the last 40 years.
Wow.
Mexico City is the worst in the world for drop.
Right. And so these pressures are occurring because the overburden is being relieved of its of the water underneath it.
So the aquifers are emptying out.
Well, the aquifers and also oil, whatever it is down there that's keeping the grains apart, is being removed. And as it does, the grains are collapsing in on each other.
Just like a dry sponge on your kitchen sink is smaller than a wet sponge.
Let's go to Sion and Saugerties. You're on.
Yes, I was listening to the comment. In regard to trees, for the past few years, I've noticed a decided acceleration in browning of white pine needles. And then I've been noticing virtually all other tree species deteriorating dramatically, almost at a geometrically accelerating pace. I wonder if any of your expert scientists might comment on that.
Well, I mean,
very dramatically.
Okay.
Well, Sion, in my water chemistry class, we talk a lot about the environmental impacts of anthropogenic practices, so what people do to the environment. And white pine are one of the canaries in the coal mine to overburdening our environment to salt. And if you've ever traveled on a highway after a big snowstorm, like the day after when the sun is out, and now you've got a dry pavement, you've still got that coat of salt that's on the pavement. The tractor trailers and the big trucks, and we drive by, and it takes those individual particles of salt, not in aqueous anymore, not dissolved. Now it's a dry particle, and it sprays it, just like pig pen on peanuts.
Yeah.
And it just goes up, and it touches, especially white pine, and white pine needles have very little defense against that. So you can use that as a way to look at the overburdening of our environment with road salt in particular.
What about if it's, these are trees which are not anywhere near any roads or any road salt?
You know, you've got transport, so it's hard to be, you know, I applaud you if you're looking at trees that aren't near roads, because most people only look at trees near roads. But if you're out in the woods and you're seeing that kind of issue, then I would, if you're in Saugerties, if you're in the Northeast, I would worry about acid rain, because that has a transport system that doesn't require cars or vehicles. It's through precipitation. And particularly, we think of acid rain as a rain issue. Snow melt and snowing actually puts a much larger acid burden on our forest than rain itself, because we use much more energy in the wintertime in order to heat our homes. And that is when we produce the acid, it gets transported in the clouds, and then it comes down in the form of snow.
Okay, Sion, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Joanna in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Joanna.
Thank you. I heard on either Canadian Broadcasting or BBC the other night a short story about small parabolic mirrors being used as cookers in Africa. And I've thought about parabolic mirrors for a long time and wondered why we're not using them for even for solar hot water versus the much less efficient systems of tubes on rooftops that don't function in New England in the wintertime. What are your thoughts about parabolic mirrors as an energy source?
Anybody?
Yeah, they work very well. They're what can I say? They use them out west because they don't have snow problems. And they have less rain to worry about as well. For example, they'll use large parabolic mirrors heating up just one tube, and then that tube would hold the water, and the water would go through the system. So they are being used, and they work very well.
More industrial settings, right?
Large areas, yeah. Certainly. But you could do that. It wouldn't make much difference as far as solar cells are concerned. The big problem with solar cells, for example, is that the frequency of light that they're affected by is more in the blue spectrum than the red spectrum, which is more of what the parabolic mirror can focus on. But they work fine, and there's no reason not to use them. It's just that you're not saving a great deal because you've got all the metal that's in the parabolic mirror as well to deal with, so it really doesn't save anything to do it that way than do it just with copper tubing.
The advantage of those mirrors that are used for cooking is that they're very portable, and they can concentrate the energy where you actually need it. So in a sense, that's one of the reasons why those are so efficient in countries where people don't have access to the kind of power systems that we do.
Yes.
And don't need to spend a lot of energy or money putting them in.
Right.
As I understand the industrial application, the parabolic mirror would then
rotate.
Focus it, and it would heat water, which would then turn a turbine.
Correct.
Correct. So you have to store the energy some way.
Okay.
Right. But for cooking food, they do work very, very well.
All right. Let's go over to line four and Michael in Toronto, Canada. Michael, you're on.
Yes. So here's a question, especially for Helmut. I was in graduate school with him 50 years ago this year.
All right.
Oh, my
so
God.
Here's the question. It has to do with sleep. Is it the case, I heard this the other day, that we seem to be no further ahead in understanding the phenomenon of sleep, how it occurs in a neurological level? And I'm amazed at that, shocked perhaps, after all the research that Helmut and all these other people have done, sticking things in people's brains and whatever.
Hi, Michael.
Hi there, Helmut.
As far as I know, we are still not very familiar with the mechanisms involved in sleep. And a lot of that work started at Stanford in the sleep labs, early sleep labs. We have a lot of descriptive information, but really understanding the function of sleep is a little bit questionable. What's changed is that we can now use a real model system because fruit flies are sleep, and so we can begin to really study the effect of the sleep and play games with some of the mutants and see if we get a little bit of a better understanding of the underlying mechanisms. And that's as close as I know to where we are now on studying fruit flies.
I have some joke about urinating fruit flies with sleep apnea, but I think don't have time for
maybe
that.
You could work for homework on that, okay. And then we'll set it up for you. And
Helmut can get me some fruit flies,
yeah.
I think.
Michael, well, thanks.
That's a frightening answer, but thank you, Helmut.
He's good at that. Thank you very much. So
you should be counting fruit flies at night. That's what you're saying?
Well, that's what we do. Huh. We watch them have sex.
Well, that's a different show.
Okay. Does that put them to sleep?
All right, then. Let's just go to any random line and just get this over with. Mary Beth in Campbell Hall, you're on. Hello, Mary Beth.
Hello there.
You're
Hello
on.
There.
Yes.
Yes, I just want to add to the gentleman. I didn't hear the whole program, but the spider mite.
Yeah.
I just was discussing this with my husband, who collects evergreens. And the southern facing, they have people note it seems to be the southern facing side. So it gets, the plant gets also dehydrated and burning. But that gentleman's right, too. The spider mite seem to be a part of it. I just wanted to add that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah,
the spider mites.
Yeah, and I wish my husband could talk to you because he could get into much more detail. I found it fascinating because I noticed it. And he had me notice that it's mostly south-facing and the roots get dehydrated. But he knows more technically how to say this, but I'm driving. So just letting you know that. So have people note that.
Okay.
And the spider mites were an issue on one of the plants, too, so it did seem to weaken the plant.
Very interesting.
We have the smartest listeners, really.
No, we always do. And it's
great. We love your show. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. All right, so what do you think, people? We got about a minute. Shall we go for...
I see we have a note about the weird apple tree.
Oh, yeah. The weird apple tree is some sort of an orange?
Osage orange.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, and three callers called up.
And we have the smartest listeners
Very smart.
In radio.
All right, I'll tell you what. Let's take one more call. Richard in Wyndham, you have about 30 seconds, my friend. Go.
All right, I'll make it real quick. Hi, guys. Great forum. You've got two male scientists and a female, and I must compliment. For all of us fellow nerds out there, it is a pleasure hearing Barbara's absolute beautiful voice and knowledge on the radio.
I can talk like that, too.
This is what pneumonia gets me.
Uh-huh. You're welcome. And to be tasteful here, Barbara, I assume you were a beautiful nerd in high school, correct?
I loved every minute of it.
Okay, but now we're running out of time, Richard. So,
thank God.
Oh, that's it?
That's it.
Wow. I didn't know you were going to schmooze
Richard,
for 20.
Richard, I'm married.
That's okay. Me too.
Thanks a lot,
guys.
Man.
Love your show.
I appreciate the call. Okay, that was...
A beautiful nerd. I love it.
A beautiful nerd who's
there's a photo
raspy
of,
voice.
Yeah,
does that mean the guys are ugly nerds?
At a GECR&D Christmas party in front of a rack of chemicals, and I'm in third grade, and it was like preordained, and I'm dressed... You couldn't dress me any nerdier than I was dressed.
Well,
dressed myself.
You certainly have improved your sartorial...
Nerdosity.
All right, we're done. Thanks a lot to Helmut Hirsch and Ed Stander and Barbara Bravitz, the very stylish Barbara Bravitz. Support comes from Valley Home Improvement, designing and building kitchens, bathrooms, interiors, and additions throughout the Pioneer Valley. Love your home, valleyhomeimprovement.com. The New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, serving the public for over 30 years, nysba.org/lawyer-referral. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades, shannonrose.com. And Stagecoach Tavern at Racebrook Lodge, Route 41, Sheffield, presenting Swing Night at the Barn, featuring John Suters, Bobby McVitie, and Charlie Tokars, Saturday at 7:30 p.m., rblodge.com. Thanks again to our scientists. Thank you for listening and for calling in. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Deb Malik. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a delicious, they tell me it's delicious, I don't know what it is, it's Food Friday tomorrow. Stay tuned now for a news update.